Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to call the October 17th Transportation and Land Use Committee meeting to order. The first item on our agenda is the cellular availability study recommendations. I'd like to welcome representatives of our Communications Commission this morning. If staff would like to go ahead and begin, thank you.
Good morning, everyone. The item that we're presenting this morning is a follow-up to our presentation that we gave on September 19th regarding the cellular gap study analysis that was performed by the Atlantic Group. And members of the Communications Commission are here to speak more to that this morning. Before we get started with our MAP presentation, first of all, I'd like to introduce Mr. Zenon Dragos, who is now on board with the Department of Information Technology as our cable franchise administrator. And this is Mr. Dragos. Additionally, one of the last issues that was raised during the meeting was a discussion or a question posed by Supervisor Clark regarding the school's position on the gap study analysis and broadband in Western Loudoun County. So Mr. Mike Larson is here with us today, and he can provide his input regarding the body of work that's been put together so far and the school's position on the gap study analysis.
Good morning. I am Mike Larson, the Director of Technology Operations and Support for Loudoun County Public Schools. Excuse me. And in response to Supervisor Clark's question, she posed first at the school board meeting about a month and a half ago, and then again at TLUC, the last meeting. The schools have had a member on the Communications Commission since it was first developed as the Cable Franchise Commission. I was on that committee from 1998 to about 2005. I'm back on the committee again, but the schools are in full support of the gap analysis. In the 18 years that I've been at the school district, our intent and budgets have been developed to ever increase the capabilities within the schools, increase the broadband and the access to the internet, as well as the LAN capabilities within the schools. We've put wireless LAN into every building within the school district to give more access to kids wherever they are in the building. So we're in full support of the gap analysis study. The problem that we're running into is that we've made our networks robust, but the kids in the West go home and the work that they need to do on the internet they can't do because they don't have the access in their homes. So it's important to the educational process that the kids continue to have access, whether they're in the building or at home. So the implementation of what's laid out in the gap analysis is important to the kids once they leave the four walls of the schools. So Loudoun County Public Schools is in total support of what they're trying to do. So thank you.
Excellent. Are there any questions from the committee? Mr. Chairman?
The one thing I need clarity on is the school board or the administration supportive of putting monopoles on school properties?
There's a facilities meeting coming up. I believe it's later this week or next week at the school board to discuss that topic.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
To continue, we have, as staff, in recognition of the questions that were raised in the last meeting, asked staff to put together the maps that are on either side of you at this point in time. What we've done is, with the help of the mapping department, we have mapped all of the towers in Loudoun County. And then, in addition to mapping the towers that are already in the county, what we have done is we have taken the results of the gap analysis study and then placed circles on the map for the projected areas for communications towers within the county. One thing that I do want to say about this, however, is that these are just projected locations as a result of the study. These are not specific necessarily locations. And regarding the extent or the character or the specific location of these or any of the site work, that has not been done. But we did want to, for purposes of discussion today, show where the gaps were identified and where proposed communications tower locations should be located. I have Mr. Tim Dennis here, who's with the Communications Commission, and he can answer any specific questions or provide additional information about how this was put together.
Thank you. Actually, what would be helpful for us, if one of you could speak and the other one could go and point, so that we and the public have a clear understanding of this is where we currently have capabilities, and this area is where there is a gap, so that everyone understands the map.
Mr. Dennis will speak from the map.
Perfect. Thank you.
Good morning. Tim Dennis, Catoctin District Communications Representative. So a couple of key things. As you can see, if you can visually pick up from a distance, you can see a continuity between east and west of blue dots. And these blue dots, when you drill into the data, you'll see a LOU number, which is a representative of an assignment in the Loudoun County GIS database of locations. So these locations could be, if we look here on Route 7, there's a few of these locations that are not actually a tower. They're rooftop installations. You get out to the west here on Snickersville Turnpike, and this would be a silo at the intersection of Snickersville Turnpike. So blue does not necessarily denote tower. It denotes a permitted commercial CUP that has been issued in the Loudoun County land process. So you can see some aggregated together in which I'm not quite sure what that installation is. So having a good base understanding of what is in place. What is important when we get to western Loudoun County, west of 15, is if we take this Loudoun, that's the water tower, I'm sorry, this is Loudoun Heights. This is a tower that's at the north end of Short Hill Mountain, just before the Potomac River. And this location is very, very important for this part of the county because both it supports what I would refer to as three different layers of important communications. So this has cellular or telephony installation permitted on this location. This has Loudoun County's public safety network installed on this. And additionally, it is one of the key anchor points in Loudoun Wireless's wireless internet network serving north of the river all the way here into Lovettsville and significantly down all the way down to Short or to Hillsboro into this area. This, for instance, is a lattice tower, and today, if you went to duplicate that tower, it's an important site, but today we could not duplicate that site because of our land policies and prohibitions of ridgeline development or installation. So that's a perfect example of something that could not be done today. So having an understanding of those existing infrastructures, this location here, continuing down Short Hill Mountain, Hillsboro, that is a site that actually used to belong to, whether it was through lease or ownership of the land, I'm not sure which, but belonged to Loudoun County. And then it was a part of the original radio network that was installed in the 50s, and now it's privately owned. And that site also, just like this, houses, I don't know if it houses land mobile for public safety, but it definitely has almost every single carrier, and it also has Roadstar's hub for this area. So that's understanding the importance of the existing blue dots is critical as we start to transition to what are called, or the acronym that has been used, and it originates with our consultant, the Atlantic Group, PCTDA. We kind of played with the projected and the communications that actually was proposed commercial, and we thought those two terms were potentially inflammatory. We needed to have a discussion, and we thought the term commercial misrepresented what we were trying to do. So our team proposed to change it, and we all agreed to change it to projected commercial, or excuse me, communication tower development areas. So through this legacy of work that Atlantic Group has done, they've created dots on a map that create a projected area of need. If we go down here, we see a commonality. This is the Camp High Road up off of Limekiln Road. That's a very interesting one. You see that this kind of proves out Atlantic Group's methodology. You have a blue dot. AT&T came in and zoned a site, and it literally occurred just about on top of, and it actually hits probably within a few feet of what the Atlantic Group projected. It's important to understand the Atlantic Group's methodology and the foundation that they did here. Based on the budget that we had to work with, it is a desktop analysis using the known database of existing blue dots and then creating a projection of what a carrier could achieve using the 800 megahertz, the different frequency bands that the carriers operate on. So this we have kind of a proof. I look at this as a proof. This site has not been built yet. AT&T actually lost funding to construct that after they went through the process and actually permitted it. And for full disclosure, I have teamed up, my company has teamed up with Camp High Road and has picked up that lease, and we're working to try and commercialize that location. But this proves out the methodology. So we have locations that throughout Western Loudoun County, the focus was here. We did not apply it. No search rings or no rings here in Eastern Loudoun County does not mean there's no need here, but the dollars and the methodology was applied to the West so that we could achieve what we had with the budget. These rings and the diameter of the ring, there's no prescriptive math or science behind it. We picked a random based on recommendation of Atlantic Group to do a 1 mile diameter, half mile radius of each center point. It would be important to note that if we look out here and we pick the site in this part, I'm thinking that's probably up around St. Louis. Without the roads, it's hard to discern. But that site at a half a mile does not mean it's going to cover, for telephony, that's going to cover an entire region. This is not going to cover every single homeowner in this area. There's going to need, if you go back to the report that the commission presented in September, you'll recall that we projected approximately 15 tower structures, which aligns with this, plus an additional 40 to 60 80-foot wood pole structures. Those 80-foot wood pole structures are more utility pole-like infrastructure where a homeowner or a group of homeowners could drop a pole in. That pole would have the ability to see over the trees and the terrain back to this tower to make connectivity and then would transmit to 6, 8, 10 homes in an area. So hopefully I've addressed questions on the map.
Are there questions for Mr. Dennis? Thank you for the presentation. It's very helpful. Supervisor Clark.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the president. I apologize for being late. I was in a meeting upstairs. So I missed the talking to you folks, school system, so we'll get back to that. In terms of the carrier provisioning on these towers, I know that it's not consistent, that it's different on different towers. I could be out in a general area. Sprint's my provider, for full disclosure, not that it makes any difference, but I could be out in an area and there'll be AT&T and Verizon on the tower, but Sprint not be on the tower. So has there been any discussion and analysis of that?
Let me make sure I clarify the question so I answer the correct question. Is your question, did Atlantic Group or the commission evaluate on to the granularity of which carrier is where?
Yes, either the Atlantic Group or you folks, the commission.
We have not drilled, I would say we have not drilled below a generic RF analysis. In other words, a frequency band that is used by telephony carriers and what does it provide? We've not drilled to the layer of which carrier uses which band and who is where.
Okay. See, that would be a recommendation that I would have, because where we have existing infrastructure, if it can be fixed by getting an additional carrier there in order to help complete the connectivity picture for that area, it seems to me that would be a simpler solution, at least for that problem. We have huge holes of connectivity, period, in Western Loudoun. Of course, these maps represent that void very well, but there's so many aspects of this to fix. If staff, for example, could move forward with looking into that, I think that would be helpful.
I've made a note prior to to you arriving, Ms. Clark, I introduced Mr. Zenon Dragos, who is now our cable franchise administrator, and so we'll be keeping track of upcoming projects, and this would be a potential upcoming project that he could tackle.
Okay. All right. So we're not isolating him to just the cable franchises?
No, we are not.
Okay. So what is your official title? What is his official title?
He's the cable franchise administrator, but there's more involved in what he's doing than just cable franchises. Obviously, there's a lot of work to be done with respect to the gap study analysis, broadband analysis, and things like that. So he's involved in all of that.
All right. I just don't want us to go backwards. You know, we changed the cable TV open band systems from the commission for the commission to the communications commission to be with today's climate and need, you know, communications, connectivity overall. So
we recognized a need for a position back when we were discussing this last year for someone to monitor and keep and have oversight of the reporting requirements and the various elements of the cable franchise agreements, and we didn't have somebody that could do that. Mr. Dragos is going to be doing that, but in addition to that, there's many, many more things that he'll be doing besides just cable franchise administration.
No, I appreciate it. Just Wendy, just a consideration, might want to consider tweaking his title so that everybody knows on a communication standpoint that he would be the point person, because, you know, if somebody was looking in the county, a provider, whatever, for who to contact with respect to cellular connectivity and so on and so forth, the cable franchise agreement person wouldn't necessarily be the person they would be thinking of contacting.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on this because I'm about produce or perish at this point in time. Sorry, it's the sales background. We had discussed updating our comprehensive plan to not have to deal with commission permits. Would this map be the equivalent of what we could update our comprehensive plan so that anything in these circles would not need a commission permit? Ms. Pastor?
The approach that we're recommending is that maybe we look more closely at that. On the surface, Mr. Dennis actually uncovered the major issue, which is a lot of where those big red dots are in areas where the plan does not allow them to be. Ridgelines.
I understand.
So therefore, you are looking at a plan amendment to do not just a map that locates the policy
and
the particular locations, but also to change the policies that would, you know, that would be we would be implementing later on. The second part is, and I know Mr. Brown is behind me, but we have had issues in the past regarding drawing circles on the plan and putting H's and E's and M's on the plan for school sites, where we have been challenged on those things as they are not significant enough to indicate that that is the location for the facility. So without saying, I can't say right today, yes, all those circles look great. We did do it for fire and rescue facilities in the plan in 2001, and we've had a couple of them be successful. So I'm not ruling it out. I'm saying that would be the approach that we would recommend is we really need to look more closely at that and answer those questions first, because if we answer that question, then the question of doing minor special exceptions or doing other things would fall into line. But that's the first piece that we would have to identify.
Okay, and I understand that. I fully assume that we would not just put a map in the comprehensive plan, that we would have to update it. My bigger concern is exactly what the gentleman from the schools just brought up, that here in Eastern Loudoun, my child can go home and do their homework assignment. And Lord knows, I'm learning now that she's in middle school, that they have to literally go online half the time to get some of their work in order and physically do things online as an assignment, that we have half of the county where these kids go home and they don't have access to a computer. So how are they supposed to get their homework done? Look, things have changed. Well, I'll give you a history lesson. Back in the 90s, they wanted to build a 198-foot cell phone tower at the fire station in Cascades. Everybody vehemently fought it. Why? Because back in the mid-90s, the only people who had a cell phone were lawyers, doctors, and drug dealers, okay? But over time, people realized, no, need cell phone coverage. And when the Invisible Tower folks came in, they said, hey, we can do it. We can put it inside, you know, this thing, and they can hang the hoses, and nobody notices it. You had a petition with hundreds of people, the same people who didn't want the tower 10 years before, saying, please, give us a cell tower. The people back in 2001 who didn't want a cell tower on a ridge line back in 2001 probably weren't thinking about the fact that their kids now can't do their homework. Or worse, there are people who are getting rid of their home, you know, AT&T landline phones who now, what do you do if there's an emergency at your home and all you have a cell phone and you can't call 911? I mean, that's the reality. When this change was made, there was, what, about 80 or 90,000 less people in the county than there are now. And Supervisor Clark, I'm sure, could attest to the fact that a few people have moved in out in Western Loudoun since 2001. So things are changing.
Mrs. Volpe, I totally agree with you, and I believe even I said at the last meeting, and I think was represented even by the folks here, that this board has approved the one or two towers that we've actually gotten in here recently. Mr. Dennis just indicated that he's working on one that was already approved and doesn't have a carrier, doesn't have that. So I think we're all agreeing that, but the quickest way to that point is to get them in here. And to, if those are the places, then I think that's the way to go, is you get the applications here and we can get it done.
Okay. Supervisor Clark and then Chairman York.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being in Western Loudoun for 17 years is the reason I brought the five items on improving communications to the board. It is a serious situation. I'm very aware of the school system's situation because I worked for the school system for 11 years. My kids have been raised here. And so my question really had to do with what is the school system doing to encourage, support, and get the message out of what a dire situation this is. We know that the cable franchise analysis that was conducted showed that the level of development, if you were to show the Blue Ridge and Catoctin District residential development maps, you would see so many developments, and I know you know this, Ms. Wickens and Mr. Dennis, so many developments that have been built out there where you have more than 21 homes in a mile radius, and that's the criteria for putting in broadband in neighborhoods, but yet somehow we have a disconnect there, and we've been told that can't happen. We have a long list of excluded addresses. So we have numerous new residential developments in Western Loudoun that do not have connectivity. The kids are going to school, and they come home, and they can't do their homework. The library's only open for so much time. The cell phone connectivity issue, period, is so seriously bad out there. I can't begin to tell you, even to the extent of me being on the cell phone with the sheriff and not being able to hear him. He's down off of Sanford Road in Middleburg. But with respect to the residential development, seems to me we're in such a serious position now for these students who have mandatory online requirements that we should be looking at the residential developments that are out there that, for example, Verizon has said that they're not going to run cable. Verizon or Comcast not going to run cable because whatever reason they're not in a junction area or close enough for backhaul. We should be looking at those residential developments, and priority should be placed on getting towers or monopoles for those areas to have connectivity. And that is not all in the ridgeline at all. In fact, the majority of those circles that are represented there are not ridgeline. So that's not the issue. And so we need to do what can be done, zoning-wise or whatever, to expedite getting these things, and even if it's more of the 80-foot poles. I mean, that, to me, would seem to be the least impactful visually, the community would accept, would provide the connectivity. So what do we need to do? What action can this board take in order to facilitate getting those poles in just to get basic connectivity for many of those developments?
I think you've already, Madam Chair, can I respond? I think you, through the committee and then the discussion we had the other night at the full board, I think you've already given direction that we move forward with addressing the commission permit issue. And that's the that's solving these issues that Julie is talking about and coming back with an approach, a plan for a policy amendment where it's needed, a plan for adopting a map to some extent. And that takes care of the commission permit. The other set part of it, Mrs. Clark, is the recommendations that came from the committee the last time that you have now put in queue in the strategic plan, which is by right 80 feet and under with performance standards and minor special exception for 80 feet and greater. So to that extent, you're saying what is necessary for a zoning action, a plan policy action, we've laid that out and we're moving forward with that.
Okay, and I appreciate that. That'll be helpful. One request I have for building and development is as you're working with these developers, who are building out there, they own the land, they have the ability to help this process to be able to put or to allow monopoles to go in there. And to that, I just want to add, I had a conversation with NOVEC yesterday because, unfortunately, I'm having to work with all the utilities all the time on some major projects. And apparently they have a program in place with Prince William County and Fairfax County where their facilities are with Milestone. And Milestone, I know, the county has a contract with. So it is a simple, in fact, I have material sitting here and on my iPad that they've sent. But a simple arrangement, a simple agreement, we should be putting things like that in place. We have NOVEC in a lot of areas out there. They have facilities. We have Milestone. Let's get them connected together.
And that
We're working on that. Actually, the Zoning Ordinance Action Group has been working with that, and that's one of the reasons I pushed with the PDH.
Okay, this is different, though.
But that's the first piece of it.
No, but this is different in that they already...
We have already signed a contract with them. We're about 10 months into a 10-year agreement with them.
I understand, but... I understand that, the facilities, but there's an actual agreement that NOVEC and Milestone strike in order to put the monopoles on their property.
Yes, it is included. That's why we did the public use sites. I said public use sites so that we can cover not only, say, like a fire station or a school or the county government building,
right,
but we could look at, like, a substation for Dominion or NOVEC, you
know,
that type
and
of
thing,
or Mountain
asked
Water
for
that matter.
And when I had asked for the inventory analysis, that's what I had asked for, too, and I appreciate that. But, you know, to me, that is such a simple solution. If somebody could, you know, talk to NOVEC, they just found out about our issue and to the extent they just pulled the information.
I understand. So. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your patience.
I think I forgot what I wanted to ask. How many applications do we have currently for cell towers?
I think we have a couple.
Just a couple?
Just a couple.
Yeah.
But they're inactive right now.
Oh, okay.
And again, I think that's the only thing I would add is, in the meantime, I know the urgency. The meantime is working with industry to bring in an application so that it can get done. We can process these things pretty quickly, we have. It's just we've got some that are inactive that aren't moving.
Yeah. So why not just map the whole county for a commission permit and be done with it? And then that way we, through the zoning ordinance, control what is by right and what is special exception.
Don't believe that's possible.
Mr. Chairman, the code says the feature has to be shown on the plan. So we can't do it with text. You have to actually show them. So that's why we're proposing to try to show as many as we can within the areas that the commission feels would be the areas to fill the gaps, because we have to show them.
But you're showing them the county is an appropriate location for cell towers, Ron.
It has to be a feature on the plan.
They have to be shown on the plan. I'm just telling you, they have to be shown on the plan, and I don't think that'll fly.
I understand. I've already had an argument with you about something else, which you've come to the conclusion you agree with me on. So I'm just talking out loud. Why is it then telephone poles don't have to go through a commission permit? I mean, what constitute the need for something to jump into the commission permit process?
Everybody sees.
I get it right the first time.
Is this thing on?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the button?
No.
It's automatic.
And you don't get a time limit.
Most telephone poles are simply normal service extensions of public utilities. And if it's just a normal service extension, there's a provision in the state code that says that that does not require a commission permit. If some portion of a utility that normally would require a commission permit is part of, but only a minor part of, another application, a rezoning that we approve or a subdivision that we approve, if it's part of that application but it's not the major part of that application, then it's deemed to be a feature and doesn't have to have a commission permit.
Okay, if a telephone pole came in at 199 feet, would it need a commission permit? Or is it because it's a telephone pole, it doesn't matter what size to be?
I'm guessing that our zoning administrator would say that that's not a normal service extension and therefore would have to have a commission permit.
Interesting. Well, I
ordinance right now allows, you know, DAS facilities on telephone poles in rural Loudoun. I mean, we already put that in the ordinance.
I'm sorry, allows what?
The distributed antenna systems.
Okay.
So we already have that in our ordinance, and that can be done now. It's just felt that it's not really sufficient in rural Loudoun because where the telephone poles are not really where close to the actual.
It's just maybe something that perhaps we need to ask for a code change down in Richmond this next year to make it just a little bit easier. But that's a different discussion then. So then should we draw, we can't even draw a bigger, we have to have a dot and a radius. We cannot draw corridors.
I would say no, and I'm thinking back to sort of what became a dialogue between the town of Percival and the county and the court and the Supreme Court about whether or not something shown on the map and where we placed it were close enough to be considered as the feature shown on the map. And judging from the language that we used in those opinions, I feel comfortable that we can't just put a dot in the middle of Loudoun County and Leesburg and put a circle around the county and say it's shown on the entire county. I would not feel comfortable trying to defend that, but I will if you want me to.
Based on current code. Okay.
Yep. The other
thank
thing,
you.
Mr.
Follow-up question, please.
Sorry.
Mr. Brown, as an example, though, would something like that with the dot and a circle around it, would that be, in your opinion, defensible?
I would say yes, and the circle is not necessarily the limiting factor. It was a very close call. As you may recall, the Western Loudoun High School, where it was shown on the map and where it was actually placed, were what, 2.5 to 3 miles apart, and it was a real close call about whether that 2.5 or 3 miles was close enough to the spot to be considered not to require commission permit. So while Mr. Dennis's dots are like half a mile from the dot center of the dot to the edge of the circle, it could be that the half a mile is not the limit, but placing the dots, because the language is just the general or approximate location, as you know. So we could maybe come within, you know, a couple of miles of those dots and still be considered okay.
I think we did that for the fire and rescues, the ones that are on the plan right now. The fire and rescue dots are about the same situation.
Okay. Excellent.
Madam Chairman, can I just kind of also respond to Mr. York's other concern?
Before you do it, then I'll ask this question so you can address it. So then not why draw the radiuses to be 3 miles?
We can draw them as 3 miles, but that doesn't mean that a court ultimately is going to say that 3 miles is close enough, because the courts ultimately get to decide
Ron, with all due respect, you can't have it both ways. In one way, you're saying, well, if we're maybe within 2 miles, even though we got circle, we may be all right. All I'm saying is expand the circle, which gives you a greater latitude on your map showing the citizens where you're projecting the need.
Well, it's a question of reasonableness, and I think the point would be you could get challenged. That's what Ron is saying, is if somebody, you know, if you did apply it, then
I understand that, Julie, but you're going to get challenged if you're going to move that dot on the outside of the circumference that you're showing on the map.
Well, then they could come in for a commission permit. That's the point, is that it doesn't mean that it's limited.
Julie, give it up. Either tell us that if something is located outside of the ring, has to be commission permit. Don't sit here and tell us that, well, quite possibly, in the instance of the high school, it's 2 miles from where this, and we got it in. And you can't have it both ways. Either we're going to expand the circumference to give us more latitude, and yes, we may be challenged, but don't tell us that quite possibly if we go ahead and locate a monopole on the outside of one of those circles, that we might be able to get away with it.
May I have a word just a second? I think the circles are legally insignificant. We put the dots there only, and then when it comes up as where the actual place is it needs to be, the circle doesn't limit. The dot says it needs to be generally there, and we may decide to put it 2.5 miles from there. And it's challenged or not challenged. If it's challenged, we win. I don't think the circles are significant. It's the dots.
Mr. Dennis?
I think the balance between the two can potentially be laid at the foot, and the arbiter would be the laws of physics as opposed to the zoning laws. Those circles are arbitrary. We randomly picked them based on advice that on average, this would be. In some instances, those circles may need to be 2 miles. In other instances, they may be sufficient to be a half mile. And I believe that we could do either address the diameter with RF propagation, which is math, or we could prescribe it in advance of defining that the PC TDA in Nearsville would be 2.5 miles versus the one in the lower part of the county might only be a mile. So we could prescribe that. And then I think if it was called to court, the physics are the physics. It's not political. It's not a land use. What drives this is the law of physics, and what hangs out there is that at a certain point, if jurisdictions just generically do not start moving on this issue, that the FCC is going to act and take away our ability as a community to impact what this ultimately looks like.
All right, thank you. I think we've had an awesome dialogue. Like I said, I'm about Producer Parrish. I believe from the package it talked about probably the best process is forming a team of staff in the Communications Commission to work through any policy changes that need to be made, finalizing a map, and trying to get this moving forward to an amendment. I'm going to throw out the wild question. How long do you all think it would take for you all working together to figure out what kind of changes need to be made in the zoning ordinance and the comprehensive plan, figuring out a map? You know, we have a good basis right here, you know, to come back with a package for the board to actually be able to take action on.
We estimated the entire process from the team working through the issues and then turning it into what would be a CPAM would be about 6 months to come through the whole process.
Okay. Now, would that be a CPAM and doing any zoning ordinance language changes at the same time?
No, not at the same time. The discussion and direction that we are operating under right now is that we would start this team to form the CPAM, and that would be moving forward starting now. But the ZOAMs that are required, and it's probably one ZOAM package,
okay,
falls into queue with the rest of the ZOAMs that are current, that are awaiting the completion of the ones that are under review right now.
Okay. So, but in reality, if the board were to approve the CPAM, you know, changes, you know, depending on how things are going, I would think the zoning ordinance changes would be minor, you know, to fix this one kind of item. That would make it easier. It wouldn't be the normal kind of lengthy process we have with some of the zoning ordinance amendments that we've been doing.
For instance, one of the ones that I mentioned was that if you do this, if we are successful in mapping it, then the notion of doing minor specs, for instance, could get done. I mean, but if you can't do this map, then it can't get done. So that's an example of something that could go relatively easily. The development of performance standards, again, would be, you know, once you kind of get this under.
Right. Well, because what I'm envisioning, to be honest, is if we approve, say, a map and make changes to the comprehensive plan, other stuff could take longer, but we could do a quick zoning ordinance amendment to change it from a full special exception to a minor special exception. That one change very quickly, which would make things easier. And then you all could take your time and work on the performance standards for the 80-foot tall ones and this, that, and the other thing.
I understand, and to the extent that we could take advantage of that type of timeline, we would. But the other suggestion that we were trying to make clear was that you have an awful lot of zoning ordinance amendment work going on right now. Here is a way to start right now dealing with this commission permit issue that you know we all need in the long run. So that could take care of that, and then we pick up the zoning ordinance amendments in order of completion of all the other ones.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I appreciate the approach. Remind me again, is it a mile radius or mile diameter that you're showing on that map?
That is a 1 mile diameter.
Madam Chair, I would request that we develop a map showing a 3 mile diameter with a notation on the map. If the map is ultimately approved by the Board of Supervisors, that it be noted that we have deemed that this given area that is shown within the circumference is an area where we think it is appropriate for a utility to place in the mode of a monopole by either minor special exception or special exception, whatever it is we choose ultimately at the end of the day to do it. I think it will be very defensible at the end. And I think the appropriate time for the challenge is if when the Board of Supervisors adopted a map, if the citizens don't like it and somebody wants to challenge it, they can challenge it then. They can always challenge it. But we are making a statement that within this given area shown on the map that a utility in the form of a monopole is appropriate to provide the service and coverage that is needed for what is the health and safety and welfare and, yes, the education of the citizens of Loudoun County.
Mr. Delgadio.
Does that require a second?
Second.
Okay. That's okay. Why I had the mic. And I also wanted to comment generally that Chairman York usually has these moments at land use, and those moments are great moments. I remember when you earlier this year suggested that new applications coming in have a plan for sidewalks instead of us having to build them, you know, in the future coming ahead. And that was going to be, I think, one of the representatives of ZOAG or whoever it was, the industry said, well, that's going to come out of your buffer. I mean, of course, it's where we're putting the sidewalks anyway. So that was another one. Also, I remember another moment where you come up with a shortcut that saves a year with private schools. We took the public school special exception and minor exception and said, why don't we apply this to private schools? And so that was another year that you saved. So I'm sure I'm listing just a few of those. So I agree with you. I just wanted to joke, why don't we just make the dot solid in 3 miles in diameter? That was a joke. Thank you.
All right. I as well appreciate Chairman York's clarity of what we're trying to accomplish. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries 4-0-1 with Supervisor Higgins absent for the vote. Just want to confirm that staff has total clarity since it was an oral motion.
Sure.
You're good? Excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much. Again, on behalf of not only our committee but the full board, we're deeply appreciative of everyone's efforts to try and help improve the situation for our residents. And I'm sure, Mr. Brown, you will be very helpful in figuring out how to legally cover our backsides as we move this item forward. All right? Thank you very much.
Are you joining us at 12? Well, thank you.
Next item on our agenda this morning is the overview of the planned bicycle and pedestrian facilities around future Metro Rail stations. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Ma'am. Who is going to carry point on this? Okay, Mr. Moserak. No, I understand. We'll give you time.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the commission or committee. I'm Lou Moserak with Transportation and Capital Infrastructure. We're here today to provide an overview of the planned bicycle and pedestrian facilities around the future Metro Rail stations in the county. Next slide, please. This came at the direction of the TLUC last month during discussion of the Ashburn-Sterling study. The item today discusses the location of the bike and ped facilities around future metro stations, including on-road bike lanes, sidewalks, and trails. We have an overview of existing facilities, proposed facilities, as well as recommendations that came from a recently completed bicycle and pedestrian study in this area. Multimodal, actually go back, please. Just kind of an overview. Multimodal access to the Metro Rail stations requires development of course, bike and ped facilities. There's a number of approved developments, as you know, around our metro station areas, and the facilities will be developed in accordance with CTP policies. Next slide. I wanted to start first with the 772 station area. Constructed the network in this area is envisioned to be constructed primarily by the developers of Moorfield Station and Loudoun Station. In coordination with the Metro Rail project. Next slide, please. This is a graphic of the most recent concept plan for Moorfield Station as recently revised this spring. Initially, Moorfield Station rezoned in 2002. You'll note on here there's a yellow, really a loop trail shown in yellow on the map. accessible to bicycle and pedestrians, providing access to the station area from several different directions, primarily from the south.
It would be helpful because I'm having difficulty seeing. Can you use the little pointer and show me exactly where the metro station is?
The metro station area is right in this vicinity.
Okay.
There is a loop trail that comes over.
I'm trying to figure out why that one was over there, and I was like, okay, thank you.
Just given the urban character of the area, the decision was made to have a more circumferential trail in the area, and we'll get into more of that here going through the presentation. In general, as I said, the outer edge of Moorfield Station, bike lanes have actually been incorporated on a segment of Moorview Parkway. A short segment exists today, and that is going to continue north up, further north along the segment of Moorview that the county will be constructing here in the near future. Within Moorfield Station, generally it's a grid pattern. The streets have low design speeds. They'll have on-street parking, wide sidewalks, street trees, and street furniture really meant to give an urban fabric to slow vehicular speeds and really, you know, facilitate on-street bicycling within those street sections. Next slide, please. Now, on the other side, as you know, we have Loudoun Station on the north side. From 2003, the initial rezoning, much smaller than Moorfield Station, but of a similar character. In particular here, there is a sidewalk really along the western side of the development, shown in blue. And on the eastern side of the development is a multi-use trail that will lead to the station area, as well as to the transit connector bridge. And I'll point that. Here's your primary multi-use trail along Metro Center Drive leading to the transit connector bridge, and that'll connect here into the station area. The entry pavilion is in this vicinity here. Okay, next slide, please. And the transit connector bridge, as I just mentioned. Next slide. Next, we'll move to the Route 606 station. Again, constructed with sidewalks leading from Lock Ridge Road to the parking and platform areas within the station. Next slide, please. One thing we would specifically like to note is the widening of Route 606 to the south from the Greenway down to Evergreen Mills Road includes a shared-use path along the west side of the road. The current terminus of that path is where it's shown there at the southern end of the interchange. There are no current plans to extend this trail east or to the metro station, so there is an identified gap there at this point.
Now, could that gap be taken care of with a rezoning in the area where we could ask for proffer?
It could be. It also could be just at board direction, and staff could look at facilitating some other connection in that area. So,
okay.
Next slide, please. Just in terms of there aren't many approved rezonings around the 606 station. It's largely undeveloped in that immediate area right now. This is just the West Dulles Station application from back in 2005. Has not been constructed, but it did include sidewalks along Lock Ridge Road to the north side of the station. Next slide, please. The last station that I'd like to talk about is the Route 28 station, and while it is just over the line in Fairfax County, there's the Dulles World development approved in 2011 within a half to three quarters of a mile of the area. Dulles World contains a sidewalk network as well as a multi-use trail encircling the development, and there is a proffered trail shared use path between the development into Fairfax County to get over to the entry pavilion for the station. I'd like to turn it over to Bill King now, who will talk about the recent bike ped study.
Good morning. Next slide, please. In 2013, Loudoun County secured a $30,000 grant from Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments to study the bicycle and pedestrian connectivity around the future 772 and 606 Metro Rail stations. The time frame for this study was approximately 6 months and was completed in the summer of 2014. The study area consisted of a 3-mile radius around each station and included an analysis of the existing sidewalk and multi-use trail network to identify gaps and needs, as well as a crash analysis of the study area, analysis of the bicycle level service along study roadways for on-road bicycling purposes, a safety analysis of intersections within a 1-mile radius of each station as well. This intersection analysis was focused to within a 1-mile radius of the stations as pedestrians are more likely to walk to the station within this range. The recommendations for the study include specific improvements to the sidewalk and trail network, intersection improvements, as well as other recommendations to be considered to enhance the overall bicycle and pedestrian connectivity in the areas. Also included in the study is criteria that can be used as a tool to prioritize these improvements should future projects occur. Next slide, please. So in general, the recommendations of the study follow some guiding principles. These include balancing the needs of all road users without significantly impacting the capacity of the roadway network. Considering a range of users, including varying skill ability, age, trip purpose. Enhanced driver expectancy of bicyclists and pedestrians through the use of traffic control devices and by also creating designated space for bicyclists to make both the driver and bicyclists aware that this is where they should be on each roadway. And then also the study attempts to address barriers for bicyclists and pedestrians by enhancing intersection crossings, minimizing exposure to pedestrians, increasing visibility to pedestrians, and encouraging motor vehicle speeds that are more compatible with bicycle travel. Study also recommends providing a more urban character to the areas immediately around the station areas, similar to what the proposed Moorfield Station development is already proposing. And finally, the study also notes the importance of reevaluating the needs of bicyclists and pedestrians for the area over time. Considering Loudoun is a county in constant change right now, the road network is going to continue to build out and development is going to continue to occur in these areas. And as this happens, traffic patterns will change, bicycle and pedestrian activity will also change, and the character of some of these roads will also change, especially after the arrival of Metro Rail service. Because of this, changes and additions to the study will likely be needed as a result of this evolution. So with that, I'd like to thank you and open the floor to any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does staff at this time need any direction from the board? And let me say what I'm thinking. I would like for us as a board, just as we did with the transportation network, to ensure that staff is, that we as a county are working, one, to make sure the pedestrian bicycle connectivity in the station areas are being taken care of by the time the opening of the station does occur. Doesn't necessarily mean development is going to happen to make those connections, but it's probably something fiscally that we may have to take care of with development coming forth, then to reverse the county for that. So at this point in time, would staff need that direction from the board, or are we already doing that?
At this time, staff would need direction from the board.
Okay, Madam Chair, I would like to make a motion that the Transportation Land Use Committee recommend to the Board of Supervisors that we give direction to staff to put a plan in place that works to ensure that we have both pedestrian and bicycle connectivity in and around our station locations by the opening of the Silver Line to Loudoun County.
It's been moved and properly seconded. Any discussion on the motion? Supervisor Clark?
I just have a question because of the news media and what I saw recently regarding the problems with bicycles being stolen at metro stations. And I don't know if we've made any provision for bike lockers, actual bike lockers, because the bikes being locked up in bike racks are the locks that are typically used are easily clipped and the bikes are taken. So what they've started putting in place are bike lockers for people to be able to lease and put their bikes in. So if we could, just a friendly amendment, Mr. Chairman, to include the consideration of provision of bike lockers. It's astounding the number of bicycles that, I mean, we're talking thousands of bicycles at these metro stations.
I would accept that as a friendly amendment, and that's a discussion we need to have as we're talking about the parking garages.
Thank you.
Excellent. Any further discussion? Supervisor Delgadio?
This is a joke. How about roller skates and, inline skates? Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Delgadio. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion will carry 4-0-1 with Supervisor Higgins absent for the vote. Thank you very much, gentlemen, ma'am. Y'all have a good weekend.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda, item number 3, is Joshua Hands fee refund request. And I think we are all comfortable with this, so I will take us out with a motion. I move that the Transportation and Land Use Committee approve the request to refund the $265 fee for the Joshua's Hands Fall Festival 2014 special event based on the Board of Supervisors fee waiver policy.
Second.
It's been moved and properly seconded. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion will carry 4-0-1 with Supervisor Higgins absent for the vote. Thank you, Mr. Merrithew.
Best Thank report you. You've ever given.
Okay.
Write that down.
Next item on our agenda is Special Exception 2013-0040 and Minor Special Exception 2013-0010, Loudon Water 600 Zone, Red Hill Road Water Storage Tanks. Do you gentlemen need a moment to settle in? Are you able to get your PowerPoint set up?
Yeah, we have it loaded, so we should be pretty quick here.
Excellent. Does staff have anything to add?
No, Madam Chairman. I'm covering for Judy this morning, and as you know, there were questions that were posed to Loudon Water, and they're here to answer those questions, and we'll turn it over to them.
Okay, excellent. Whenever you're ready, gentlemen.
All right. Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here this morning. With me today, Jonathan Rock is our general counsel. Mike Latham is our executive director of planning and engineering. Tom Lipinski is our manager of our planning programs. And Bob Brown with urban engineering. So we're here this morning. Wanted to appreciate the opportunity to provide some more information, give a presentation. Coming from the public hearing, we really want to narrow in and address the questions we felt were still out there came to us. So we're going to try to be as direct as possible to get to those, but we want to make sure we cover the right information. So basically this morning, start with the comprehensive plan again. That's the basis for this. But we'll talk about the site selection process, the need for the storage in the 600 zone, and then we'll get to the elevated storage in a comparison with the ground storage. Again, starting with the comprehensive plan. Going back 10 years, we talked about this at the public hearing. The Board of Supervisors at the time opened up the entire area, the TPA, the transition policy area, for our central system. And for us, and what that does is it really is a guide for us, and it sets expectations around the language, the efficiency, and the effectiveness, And clearly, in our industry, the use of elevated storage and using gravity is without question the best utility system for water. That's been part of our planning program, what we've been looking at, what we have been planning for. For us, while there may be different development patterns in the between the suburban policy area and the transition policy area, the level of service, the level of expectation of our service is the same across that entire area. So that's the way we look at our system. We want to provide the same level of service across the entire area. I want to get into the site selection process and how we arrived at the current site that we have in front of you. It's a very structured process. It's objective. It's criteria driven. It begins with the language in the comprehensive plan again. So I want to start there. I want to make a distinction. We've often talked about site selection, and there's a site screening process. I'm going to make a quick distinction there. When we begin, we really look at a broader area you can see on here, which is basically the entire zone, the 600 zone. And we've talked about in some of the responses during this process, we've even referred to a specific list of 17 criteria. That's a screening process, a desktop analysis, where we begin to narrow down the areas here. And through that process, we've narrowed down to this sort of center area from a hydraulic standpoint in this pressure zone that we want to be in. We've talked about that in the past. So I'm going to go to this map here because you've seen this before, explain this at the public hearing. But as we begin to go from that screening process and begin to look at specific properties that are suitable for this use, in the public hearing we talked about and we showed on here the contours we have on here are around the 420 mark and above. That is a minimum that gets us to a suitable height for the structure, gets us to the 600 level that the water is sitting at for the purpose of the elevated storage tank. We've added some graphic here to show, if you watch the change here, those highlighted areas are really our options for a storage tank in this pressure zone. It's pretty limited. And so that narrows down the choices that we're looking at. Now, as we've talked about the screening and the criteria that we look at, some of them rise above and are the most important. Land availability, and that is having a willing seller. Key to the whole thing. If we don't have a willing seller.
Mark, I'm a little confused and looking at the map. Yep. What's your highlighted areas? I see a ton of colors on your map.
Right. The highlighted area is kind of the bluish gray, and that is the areas that are within the transition policy area, and they're at elevation 420 or above.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but I'm not really picking up the bluish gray. Do you have a laser pointer you can point to the map?
This area.
Oh, those areas. Okay, yeah, thank you.
Sorry about that. And so looking at this, I want to talk very specifically here about the three properties that we've referenced in this process that we've looked at.
Before you get to that point, Madam Chair, I have a question.
If I may. Sure.
Just to go back to the highlighted areas, mm-hmm. that you said are the only areas for storage tanks in the high pressure zone, that would be for elevated storage tanks.
That's right.
The ones that you prefer to install.
That's right.
Not that storage tanks couldn't go anywhere else. It's just with you wanting to install them that way, that's the zone that they would have to go in.
That's correct.
They're elevated. Mm-hmm. I just want that cleared up. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So we have, I know it may be a little difficult to see, but we have, let me go back real quick. We have the white box there. There is a tank 1, tank 1A, and a tank 2. Okay, the Tank 1 and Tank 1A are the sites that are on the Willowsford property. In 2011, we did a study. We were interested. We were looking at those two sites. The recommendation from our study, they both had advantages, but the recommendation was the tank site 1. The other critical issue on that is that Tank 1 was also the site that Willowsford was willing to go into contract with us. After we looked at the sites, they were not interested in going into contract on the tank site 1A. That's the one we've referenced. It's near a cell phone tire. That took that out of the equation. So we have we had a contract on tank site 1. That's the one we put together a land use application. We went out 2 years ago, went out to the community with that site, explained what we were moving on, received a lot of feedback. And it was at that time that Supervisor Clark sent a letter to our board asking that we take a look. We did that. We went through our screening process, looked at quite a number of sites again. During that process, the tank site 2, which is on Mr. Rouse's property, came up through our screening process. We approached him, began talking. Ultimately, we're able to work out a contract on that site. At that time, we had a choice to make. And as we looked at those two pieces of property that we had under contract, there were some advantages to that Rouse site. It was in closer proximity for our access to public roads, and so there was a difference in cost there. As you look at it on the map, you can see it's closer to existing water lines that are in the ground, and it was the furthest one away from the rural policy area, from all three of them actually, but particularly from those two. And so we moved forward on that piece of property. At that time, Supervisor Clark had been engaged in the process. We were in conversation, and she was supportive of our moving specifically from the other site to that site. In terms of putting together this application. That's the application we now have. We no longer have a contract on the site 1. That's not available to us anymore. We've even talked with the Willowsford folks since the public hearing. That's not available to us at this time. They're not interested. We have a property under contract. That's the site that we're moving forward with.
Madam Chair. Just for the record, mm-hmm. to correct things. So with respect to the process and you finding alternative sites, I was supportive of you finding alternative sites and doing the outreach to the community, not with respect to the aspects of this application. Thus, I sent you the letter with respect to this location as well. So in terms of the actual site that's, you know, at the time that you located the site, that was one of the only sites that you said would work for you. So I supported your outreach to the community. We've since headed down the road of understanding the technology and what the other options are, and know that you have other options. Been out there to Red Hill Road, seen the tremendously difficult conditions and non-supportive environment for putting something like this in. So I do not support the application.
Okay. So we're going to now move into and talk about our other two areas, the need and the elevated in comparison to the ground storage. And Tom Lipinski is going to take it from here.
Thank you and good morning. I'll start off by moving into real briefly the need for the 600 zone water storage tanks. The need for future water storage out there or the water storage out in the zone is based on the current build-out plan in accordance with the comprehensive plan. We did a master plan updated in 2012, work with county staff to get the projections of what the population and employment growth is going to be throughout the county. We put that into the 600 zone area, and we use that to determine what the future water needs will be for this area. And then based off of that, we determine what the future water storage volumes that will be needed to meet those. So there's no speculation in here. There's no additional demands thrown in for any sort of future upzonings or rezonings. This is based off of the current county's comprehensive plan and how that's currently zoned. Also, the 600 zone tanks are not put out for a specific development. They're not there for Willowsford or for Greenmill Preserve, any of them. They're there. Those tanks are there to support all the development that will occur within that 600 zone. In the future, we estimate those demands to be about 1.8 million gallons. And just for comparison, that would be when our total system demand might be around 44 million gallons. That's about a 5% of the total system, to just give you a sense. Obviously, with it being transition policy area, the demands out there won't be anywhere near as high as they would be further in the east where we have the dense development. So, again, this is just a map showing the different pressure zones that we have. The green in the east, what we call our 510 zone. The blue here sort of in the northern Ashburn area, 538. And then here in the yellow, this 600 zone, which is on the western side of the service area and out near the rural policy area boundary. You can see that the 600 zone is completely within the transition policy area. That transition suburban line is shown on here as dashed. And how we'll feed this system, or how we feed it even now, is we have a pumping station located right here at the bottom of the 538 zone, and we have one down here in the 510 zone. And those pumping stations pump water out to the 600 zone. Right now, we do not have the tanks out there, so once we get the tanks out there, those pumping stations will be the stations that will fill water into the 600 zone tank. Just a little bit about why 600 as an elevation. This shows, again, the three different zones that we have in our system, 510, 538, and 600. And really, the key is this row of data right here, the high ground elevation served. You can see that it's 420 in the east, closer to the Fairfax line, and then 430 and 490. So we've kind of segmented the area based on the high ground and making sure that we meet our pressure requirements at the homes that are at the high ground. That's what really drives how high up in the air we have to get the water to make sure that they have the adequate pressure. So you can see that the consistency here, about a little over 100 or 110 feet, being used in most of these applications. So the same criteria for the 600 as for others.
Thank you. Just a question while you have this graphic up.
Yes, sir.
I'm only aware that you, Loudoun Water, have three tanks currently built in the eastern end of the county, two in Bramilton, the other one in Sterling. Do we have any other tanks?
Yeah, actually, we have a total of seven tanks right now.
Okay.
Okay, we have the one in Sterling, as you mentioned. There's two sets of tanks along Route 659. The Brambleton tanks is a pair,
that's
and then
right,
the ones
the other set, okay.
The northern set, and then the Dulles South tanks that are down off Goshen Road.
Does the tank in Sterling also require a pumping station to help supplement pressure since it's not up in the air?
Actually, it does. Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I have a question as well, since you're on the water towers and the height. So for the water tower in the on Belmont Ridge Road, you have a tower height of 73 feet and an elevation of 472 feet. And then in Brambleton, you have a tower height of 146 feet, elevation 408 feet. Then in Dulles South, you have tower height of 170 feet and an elevation of 357 feet. The proposed towers that you're talking about here, you're proposing 189 feet, which is 75 feet higher than the tallest. The tallest ones that you have on here, the Brambleton ones. And so I really don't understand that.
I'm sorry, did you say 75 feet taller than the highest?
75 feet, because you're saying 189 feet for these towers that you're proposing.
The Dulles South tanks are 167 feet tall, so these would be about a little over 15 feet or 20 feet higher than
the. But in terms of the elevation, if you compare the tower height, the elevation, and the skyline height, it's actually 75 feet, so because Broadlands for the skyline height is 545 feet, Brambleton 554 feet, Dulles South 527 feet, and then Red Hill with a skyline height would be 620 feet.
I'm not sure about the all of those numbers, but I can speak to
how about this? We'll slow it down for those of us who were not good at things like geometry and earth sciences. Start at the beginning. The low ground elevation served. That is a house that's only 310 feet above sea level.
That is correct.
Okay. And so then the high ground elevation served is for a house that sits 490 feet above sea level.
That is correct.
Okay. So then the zone at 600 feet would mean, in reality, 110 feet above where the house at 490
the highest
is sitting.
House, that's right.
Okay. All right, so that helps.
Can I add something in there? Yeah. Is that if the tank, if you could build the tank at this high ground elevation, if that were available, then you would need to build a tank that had the water 110 feet up in the air plus whatever additional height above that the tank is, about another 15 to 20 feet from the high water level in the tank. If you could build the tank at the high ground elevation, in this case, in the 600 zone, the 490 high ground elevations are already developed. They exist in Green Mill Preserve and they exist in Lena Run. So we don't have the ability to build the tank at the highest elevation. No matter where you move the tank, then the water level still has to stay at 600 so that you can always provide the pressure to those homes at 490. But if you start going on a lower ground elevation to build a tank, if you build it at a ground elevation, say where we found ground, which is at 430, that instead of the tank being 110 feet tall, it has to be about 170 feet tall. The top doesn't change, but you're moving the bottom of the tank sort of down the hill, so the tank appears to be taller, but the top of the elevation, no matter where you put it, stays at 600, and you just make the tank taller. That is why we have some tanks. There's a pair of short tanks in the Broadlands area that are only 75 feet tall. Honestly, they're inadequate to serve the homes around them because of the way they were designed. And I believe what happened years ago was there was the intent that all those homes, when they were going to be developed, would have individual booster pumps put inside the homes that would be developed around them. That never occurred, so we actually had to create a boosted pressure state zone around those tanks. So the people who are living right around those tanks are not directly being served by the elevated tanks. We have to modify that and build a pump station to serve them in that area. If we had to do it all over again, those tanks would have been built, I think, higher.
Okay, thank you.
So tank height does not necessarily exactly translate into the water pressure.
My point is being, I understand the business you're in, sir, and the technical aspects of this that you're responsible for covering, and that the construction and the function and operations of these facilities is all you care about. But we have to look at everything holistically. The impact to the surrounding property owners, to the saleability of homes, economic development, so on and so forth. And so what you're talking about in terms of having to have them this height or having to do it that way, I'm of the knowledge now, having to unfortunately become so educated on this by contacting other jurisdictions, by getting additional information, that this all has to do with the way that you folks choose to construct these towers. You've just said yourself that you're going to build a pump station. You work with pump stations. You know, I have reams of information that show the benefits of ground storage, grounded tanks versus the elevated. I also, you know, in our surrounding jurisdictions, and we've had this discussion before, they have varied the way, they have hybrid systems because they care about their community. They care about their county. They care about making sure that the right thing goes in the right way so that it fits with the surrounding area. And we've done that with schools. It was a very difficult thing to get them to move off of status quo and get them to build two-story schools. I mean, I watched that thing go on forever, decade. And finally, we got to that point. You gentlemen doing wonderful work, it's time to graduate to the next level, like our surrounding jurisdictions. We're a progressive county. We have 56 data centers. We have a lot of innovation, a lot of businesses that want to be here. We have folks that invest a lot in the homes that they purchase in this county, and we owe it to them to put the proper technology and the proper facilities implemented in the current day and age in keeping with the surrounding area. So, you know, I have a number of points to make, but I want to let you finish your presentation. I just want to say that when you say you have to do it this way, you don't have to. It is a choice that you are making.
Sir, if you'd like to continue.
Thank you. So let me move, and I think we understand why we set the pressure zone to 600. And the next thing I did want to talk into a little bit, it was about the difference between having elevated storage or having ground storage out here. As I mentioned, here's the map again, and we have two pump stations located here in the east of the 600 zone. And they will pump water out they pump water out now into the system. And the way the system is designed, the way we have planned it, consistent with the rest of the central system, is this is an example of one of those pump stations. And with an elevated storage tank out there with a water level and at a maximum water level of 600 feet, when this pump station is pumping water, there's a network of pipes that exist between this pump station and the tank. And that same network of pipes has all of the customers that live in these areas connected to them. So when this pump station starts pumping out water, it has to pump the water through the same pipes that are going to feed the customers as are going to fill the tank. So when it pumps the water out, it pumps it up to this imaginary elevation of 600. That's what creates the water pressure. So that as the water is traveling from the pump station to the tank, and it's going to the customers, it's providing them their adequate service pressure, which they need, which is around 600, and then that water can go ahead and it can fill up the tank. That is what we call floating storage, meaning that the pressure in this system is all floating on whatever the elevation is in this tank. When the tank is full, the pump station shuts off, and then the customers basically receive their water from what's sitting up here in the tank. Gravity does the work for us. When the water level starts to drop down in the tank, it gets to a low level, and the pump station will kick back on to basically start to put water back into the tank. And as it's doing that, it's making sure, again, that the customers are receiving all the pressure that they need.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to interrupt presentation, but I want to ask a question and not make a speech. You require a pump house for the tall tower. What's the difference between a shorter tower that requires a pump house versus the pump house you have to build for the taller tower? Help me understand.
For this pump house here, really, it has to be able to push out to a higher pressure if the tank is taller. What would happen is if this tank was somewhat shorter, let's say you built the tank 50 feet shorter, when this pump station would shut off because the tank was filled, then the pressure these customers see is based on the water that's level that's in the tank. It's now 50 feet lower than it would have been with a tall tank, so the pressure they get is not the same pressure that you would want them to have. It's below service pressure.
So then if you were to build a tank similar to what's in Sterling, you would have to build another pump house that does opposite. Would it be the same type of pump house that you're doing to that you're building on this facility?
It would be. In my next slide, I'll actually explain that to you if that helps. Okay. So when we talk about reliability of a system, this is the most reliable system that we can build because once the water up is in the tank, gravity then can feed the customers after that. It's efficient because we're only pumping the water one time. We're pumping from this pump station, and we're pumping it out into the tank. To get the water from the tank to the customers, again, gravity does the work. And the really nice thing about this is usually we can size these and arrange these systems such that during the daytime the customers are drawing water out of the tank, and we can pump often at nighttime. That means that we get a lot better energy prices at nighttime to run the pumps rather than running them during the afternoon hours when energy is at its peak cost. So it becomes a very cost-efficient system to run, and it's very effective because you're only pumping the water once, and again, gravity is always there. So if for some reason the pump station was unable to turn on, gravity basically can take over.
Madam Chair, I have a question, and it is a question because the information that I have from the state of North Carolina says this. The fixed height of an elevated storage tank can lend itself to an inability to control changes in system pressure. If a water distribution system currently served by an elevated storage tank expands, the hydraulic grade line of the system could change, making the existing elevated storage tank obsolete. Whereas if the system was served by a ground storage tank with a booster pump station with VFDs, a change in motor, impeller, or VFD setting could address the change in hydraulic grade line. Elevated storage may place a greater strain on a water distribution system because of the need for much greater pressure to force water to the height of elevated storage. This increase in pressure means a greater energy requirement as well as an increased potential for broken water mains. Could you
honestly, without the context, that's a little bit difficult to read through. But we design our pumps to basically pump to the tanks. I suppose you could have an instance where your tanks were at a higher elevation that's necessary. Yes, that would require you to spend more pressure than's necessary. Mike, I don't know if you caught anything more out of that.
I don't know the context of that, but I could see in an area that's not well-defined, maybe it's a rural area that's they're not sure how it's going to grow. I could see where there could be some constraints there, but we know our service area as you all have defined it. So the ground, there is no technology that has replaced gravity. Gravity is the best solution for this type of application.
It's just not the only solution.
You're absolutely right.
Thank you. By the way, are these towers being used for you had to sit through that session, and they are being used because we're talking 180-foot poles and 80-foot poles, so you've got, like, real height there. Okay, that's just a question. I've got a giant pump station, as you know, in Sterling, right at by the bowling alley on right next to Drainsville Road. It's in right inside the Loudoun County border, and I understand that pump station is to bring water from Fairfax County and that water system because they have a weak system. Now, this is relevant to us, I guess. Fairfax, I don't see these giant towers everywhere. Are they hidden? Are they invisible? I would like to know.
What are you talking about? I grew up in Vienna. We all know where our tower is in Vienna. I can drive
around. The Sterling Tower is
invisible. Yeah, but
honey,
it wasn't put in by the town. It was put in by Fairfax County Sanitation Authority.
No, you know what I'm saying. I'm saying, look, Sterling's tower is kind of invisible. The chairman said it's 180 feet, is not 600 feet. So I'm asking, what's the system that they have in Fairfax, just as a matter of curiosity? I know the Vienna Tower is this tiny little thing, kind of like a model tower. Tiny. It's only 180 feet. We're talking about 580 feet here, right?
The Vienna Tower is almost 200 feet tall above the ground.
Well, 200 is not 600. I think that's what the topic for today is.
No, they're talking about building a tower that's 180 feet in height.
Okay.
Okay.
So this 500 or 600 level.
Yeah, that's why I was trying to explain that before, because everybody gets confused. You know, the previous slide. It has to do with the elevation of the physical ground and the above seawater thing.
Well, the four towers.
No one's asking to build a 600-foot tall tower.
Thank you for correcting me.
Okay.
Thank you. But the chairman referred to the, the fact that we know where some of the towers are. Four of them are on Belmont Ridge Road, as an example. So I'm like looking at the impact on the community. And when I'm driving around, I could tell you where those four giant towers are because they're visible for miles around. And, you know, we're discussing the option of adding another tower similar in nature to that. So what I'm asking is, how does Fairfax handle these large towers, and how come I don't see
it? Fairfax actually has a combination. I don't know exactly their system well, but they have a series of some ground storage tanks in their system, and they have a series of elevated storage tanks. So
here is my point. I mean, I'm a city boy. I mean, I'm from New York City, for those who don't know the accent. It's a New York accent. So I'm partial to understanding what Fairfax is doing in relation to Loudoun, and supervisor has asked, you know, hey, what about a hybrid system? I know that's coming down the pike, and that's what I naturally want to know. How come I missed it?
I was going to continue on, but I don't know if with the chairman, Mr. York having left, did we want to hold on, because he did have some questions about that.
I understand. He'll be back in a moment. If you want to try and address Supervisor Delgadio, I mean, I myself can address some of it because, you know, I grew up in Vienna, and if I had to, I could pull out on a map and probably locate at least, I don't know, half a dozen water towers in Fairfax County. So
he's going to talk about the hybrid system.
But I'm saying, you know, if you want to try and talk about the hybrid system.
All right, well, I'll move forward because what I'm going to try to show you is to go from what we plan and what we've designed around, the elevated floating storage, to go to ground storage. Seems really simple. It seems like, why not just put a shorter tank out there on the ground? But it isn't that simple. And that's what I'm going to try to demonstrate for you here through the next slide. So this slide is meant to demonstrate if you tried to take what was the very tall, elevated, again, a floating storage tank, as we would call it, and you would make it now a ground storage tank. Elevation 430, that is roughly what the ground elevation is at the site we're talking about. And let's just pretend that the height of this tank is about 40 feet tall. That's not an uncommon height for a ground storage tank. The way the system is designed, if this pump station would turn on and it would pump water out in the same manner as it did before, it has to pump that water out near an elevation of 600 so that as that water is heading out to the tank, it's also going through that same piping system the customers are connected to, and they still need that 600 sort of level pressure to make sure that they are getting their service pressure. So this pump station will operate in that same manner. When the water gets all the way out here to this tank now has, let's say its top is about elevation 470. It's 430 plus 40 feet. The pressure coming out from the pump station is around 600, and that's about 130 feet more pressure than you need for this tank. This tank is not going to become a pressurized tank. Think of it like a 40-foot tall swimming pool with a lid on it, sort of. So that's about 50 PSI of extra pressure in the water line, which we then have to put some valving and equipment in to knock that pressure down so that we can actually fill just this shorter tank and that we don't get into a situation where we would accidentally pressurize the tank. Again, it's not designed to be a pressure tank. So what happens is this pumping station is pumping water out there and it's going to the customers, and now you're killing all this energy over here so that the water goes into the tank. And that is a very ineffective and inefficient way to run a system. Not only do you kill the energy, but because the tank is so short, it can't provide any useful pressure to the customers. You have to pump it back out of that tank and pump it back up. So to Mr. York's question before, you would have to build, if we were to build ground storage out here, you have to put another pump station in order to make that ground storage usable to any of these customers. So ground storage tanks come with a pump station, and that's why we refer to it as pumped storage.
First of all, what's the height of the ground tower in Sterling? It's not 40 feet, is it?
No, it's about 100 and... let me see if I have it. Yeah, it's about 110 feet or so.
About 100 feet.
Yeah.
Is not the proposed site... Let me ask it a different way. Is the proposed site right now the highest point of your service district?
No, it's about 60 feet below the highest point of the service district.
Okay, 60 feet below. Okay.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, that all that higher ground, the high points are already occupied by homes in Green Mill Preserve and Lena Run.
Okay.
The high elevation's around 490.
But is it well above other parts of your service district?
This particular parcel?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And help me just to clarify, I wish we had the map back on there. These two proposed tanks are to serve how large of an area? Is it just a transition zone?
It's this area that you see here in yellow on this map. So if you can picture, this is Route 50. This
it's
dotted
transition
line.
Transition zone.
Okay. Yeah, it is transition, but it's not all of the transition zone. It's the yellow portion, but it's all contained. This is the transition suburban boundary line.
Okay,
this is,
gotcha. Thank
yep,
you.
Yep.
All right. Thank.
So back to this. So when you're pumping now out of this tank, you've pushed water out here to fill the tank while it was feeding the customers. You killed out all that energy, and then in order to basically take water out of that tank and give it to the customers, you have to put that energy back into it, so you have to use this pump station. So it is an extremely energy inefficient way to design a system, a very expensive way to design a system.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
I see something on there that says pressure reducing
valve.
What does that mean?
That is the valve that would be used so that when this water is coming out here at a really high pressure, that is what we use to regulate and knock the pressure down so that it basically just fills this tank to that level that we need at 470.
Okay, so you're saying as the water is coming from over here going that way, you have to slow it down before it goes into the tank.
So really knock the pressure out of it is what we really need to do, but yes.
Thank you.
So the alternate way to do this is to avoid all of that expensive energy loss is to take the same pump station that you have and to actually build a dedicated pipeline from that pump station that goes all the way out, is no longer connected to the customers, and is pumping water into this tank. When you do that, this pump station now doesn't have to pump as high as 600 because it's not connected to the customer. So as the water goes from here to here, it goes directly through a pipe, and it's just at a pressure high enough so that it'll fill the tank up. No more pressure regulating valve is needed because you're running this at a much lower pressure. Then when the customers need the water, you pull the water out with this new pump station and you pump it out to these customers at the 600 grade line. With either of these scenarios, with ground storage, the pumps are running 24 hours a day. There is no way to provide pressure to the customers in the 600 zone without the pump stations running. So that is what is nice, again, about the elevated storage. The elevated storage, you pump water up to that tank that's up in the air, and then as gravity starts to drain it down and it gets to some lower level, then the pump station turns back on to help fill the tank back up. So you have a very reliable system again.
I'm going to ask a technical question because, you know, I have always loved the fact that I'm on central water and sewer.
Yes.
What happens in this scenario if people lose their electricity? I mean, like if we have another Dereshko or whatever.
Yeah. Well,
as you said, the pumps would have to run 24 hours a day.
The pumps will always have to run 24 hours 7, no matter what's happening.
But I'm saying if the power goes out,
right,
what happens?
Well, depending on where the power outage, assuming that it hits these pump stations, then we would have, in most cases, backup power systems to try to run those pump stations. So they would have generators associated with them.
But my question is, if you have an elevated tower, does the gravity still, would the gravity help if there's
absolutely
no electricity?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why we speak so highly of the reliability of elevated storage. Once the water's up there, gravity brings it back out for free at that point. So.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up question. Let's assume for a minute your tank there is built to the height of what we have in Sterling. So it's 100 feet. So you're basically, if I remember what you said, is that this is below the highest point of about by about 60 feet. So now you're kind of even, Stephen. If you had a 100-foot tank, ground tank there, does this design change any? In that, does the concern reduce itself any?
when I looked at just if we had proposed a tank that was.
Let me just ask one other thing when you answer. If you're pumping, does that reduce the need for two tanks?
No. The volume of water that's needed is going to be based on solely the amount of customers that come out here and the amount of water that they use. The method of how you deliver it to the customers, whether you deliver it via elevated storage or ground storage, will not impact that. To your other question about the if the tank was at 100 foot, it's a trade-off and of pros and cons, and it would never alleviate one of our concerns. A 100-foot tank would still leave you that the properties at high elevations, probably anything above an elevation, I think I did a calculation of roughly around 410 up to 490, would not be able to be served adequately by that tank because it's too short. Instead of it being at a hydraulic grade line of 600, you've created a grade line of 538. So you have knocked out all the high ground from being able to be served by this tank, even if it was 100 foot tall. The second problem you have is when you try to build a tank that's 100 foot tall, like that's in Sterling, we don't build those anymore. We build shorter ground storage tanks because when you have this big, tall tank, we don't use all that water on a daily basis, and you have to manage all that water from a water quality standpoint. So nobody really builds what's in Sterling is referred to as a stand pipe. It actually means a ground tank that is taller than it is wide. It is just a technology that in the 1962, maybe, was built. Really, people don't build stand pipes anymore. If you're going to pump, there's really not a large advantage of having the slightly taller tank rather than 40 feet having the 100 feet. I'll switch back to the.
Just one moment with respect to the tank, because you mentioned you build shorter groundwater storage tanks now. Have you personally been involved with designing or building any shorter groundwater storage tanks, as you just mentioned?
When you say groundwater, you mean ground storage tank,
ground
a tank on the ground?
Is what I mean, yes.
Yes, in my career I have been, yes.
And where, may I ask?
I did consulting for 15 years as an engineer before I joined Loudoun Water. So I worked for Fairfax County. I worked for Prince William County as a consultant. So.
Okay, so you've had experience with the way they do things.
Yes.
Are you aware? They had a Water and Energy Nexus workshop in 2012 that they presented information. They have really been smart on how they've configured and designed their hybrid system. Are you aware of that at all?
When you say they, are you talking about?
Fairfax.
Fairfax. I deal with them on a day-to-day basis, but I mean, I deal with them somewhat, but not on a day-to-day basis. I'm sorry, I'm just not up to speed with everything Fairfax does.
Do you know why Fairfax and Prince William have chosen to build tanks shorter in some areas?
Primarily because I think I don't know for sure, I wasn't involved in all their projects, but primarily from a visual standpoint, mm-hmm. and in some cases I think maybe if from a land availability standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and that is one of the prime advantages of building that sort of a tank. It opens up the number of land parcels that you can consider for placing tanks as such. All right, well, I have in terms of a question about the elevated storage tanks. I have information here that says that as the water distribution systems change, evolve, and expand, hydraulic demand may change so stagnation can occur in the tank. The tank could drain quickly, or the hydraulic grade line change could make the tank obsolete. There does not appear to be a correct height for an elevated storage tank. Either the tank is high enough to handle the relatively brief periods of peak demand and too high for the remainder of the day, or vice versa. In a growing water distribution system, it may be desirable to have the flexibility to be able to change the pressure range of the system. So, your wealth of experience all these years working with Prince William County, Fairfax County, the hybrid systems, does that make sense to you?
It didn't make sense to me where it talked about something about the tank not being able to change.
I think that quote seemed to talk about the hydraulic grade line certainty. We're certain about the 600 zone hydraulic grade line. The only reason that would change is that the county decided to move the suburban policy, the transition policy boundaries further west, and we have to then serve lands further west. A ground storage, I guess, would make that easier to do if that ever happened. But, you know, the hydraulic certainty of what we're dealing with is a 600 zone hydraulic grade line, and that is a certainty.
I mean, you're reading some kind of, I don't know if those are what those are from, if they're kind of theoretical, but we have engineers on staff, we have engineers as consultants that work for us, and all of our system has been designed specifically for the needs of our system. So we feel very comfortable, as Mike was saying, with what our needs are, with what the grade lines will be, and the likelihood of them changing. I'm not sure exactly what
and
that
I
was
And I don't dispute the technical functionality or value that you're providing. I'm not disputing that, okay? I'm just trying to point out and get your agreement that there are other ways to implement these storage tanks.
Yeah, I think I was just kind of showing you that right here. Just to continue on, I mean, with that is, if ground storage were to be something that we were to pursue, we believe that we would have to build some additional pipelines to connect the pump stations directly to ground storage out there. It's not something that we've planned for. It's not something that we designed our system around. So just to speak to that a little bit, so we put together some, again, these are rough costs. We don't have designs for these. These are sort of planning level, feasibility level costs. But we have that the capital cost to build the two elevated storage tanks would be about $6.2 million. This is just in today's dollars. To put in the ground storage tanks and the pump station, that difference is probably now up. It's about $9.2 million. And then we have two pipelines that we had never planned on that we would have to basically build from our pump stations out to support that new ground storage tank. We estimate the capital cost of that to be around probably about $18 million to pursue that. It can be done. It is not the most cost-effective, and it's definitely not the most efficient way or reliable way for us to serve our customers. In addition to those capital costs, you'll pay this once at the first time, but as these systems age and 20 years from now when you need to rebuild and work on these, you're always paying some percentage of what this original cost was. In this case, 10 years, 20 years from now, if you need to do some rehabilitation at the tanks, you're doing some rehabilitation of a $6.2 million facility, as opposed to if you're doing some rehabilitation of this site, it's a $9.2 million facility. So you hit reoccurring capital costs get higher and higher as you go on. Looking at the operating costs for these two systems, again, elevated floating just based off of some numbers and some examining that we did for some study, $17,000 a year, as I mentioned with elevated. You're pumping the water once from the pump station out to the tank. Everything else is out by gravity. After that, with the ground storage and the multiple pump stations and the continuous running of pumps, you're paying a substantial premium to operate a system like that. So,
may I ask a technical question? I know I see everybody trying to grab their lights. Loudoun Water basically is one system. So, for example, Supervisor Delgadio, Chairman York, and I all live in the Sterling area. So every time we need to build one of these facilities, this is a cost in reality that's shared across all of the customers on Loudoun Water, correct? Okay. So we as a board have to make a decision whether we would like the, and of course this was a decision that a previous board made to extend water and sewer into the transition zone. I said a previous board. So part of our discussion here is whether the Loudoun Water customers across, say, the eastern half of the county would prefer to pay $6.2 million or would they prefer to pay $18 million for these folks to have their storage tanks at ground level, when the rest of us have towers. Okay.
Supervisor.
Mr. Chairman, he was first, then Ms. Clark.
I need to understand if you're putting pumping stations in for the ground level tank, help me understand why you need two tanks. Because if you're constantly pumping water, I don't understand why you need the need for two tanks.
It all has to do with the ultimate need is to have two tanks or one 2-million-gallon tank. It's 2 million gallons of storage is what's needed ultimately for the growth, again, that's planned in this area. We don't want to build two at one time because right now when the growth is just starting and the water usage is not that high, it is very difficult from a water quality standpoint to keep that extra volume of water out there fresh and guarantee that you're going to have good water quality for your customers. So we stage the water volume in.
Chairman York, the volume of storage is dictated by VDH. That is the volume of storage based on the demands that we project.
Help me understand, what is the purpose of the storage? If you're pumping to keep the pressure up, then obviously the storage is for some other reason than to help with the pressure.
The storage is there for primarily three reasons. One is people use water throughout the day in not in normal patterns. So there are times when more water is needed, like in the morning and in the evening when everybody's getting ready for work and everybody's getting ready for bed. So the pumps that we have to pump water out at a faster rate, so you need a volume of storage in there to, as we say, equalize basically the water usage throughout the day. That's one. Two, fire flow is kept in the storage tank. So we assume that there is firefighting capability at 3,000 gallons per minute for 3 hours. That equates to about 500,000 gallons of water that's stored in the tanks. So if there's a fire. And then the third reason is just for some other emergencies that might occur. If a water main was broke or things of that nature, we have extra volume of water sitting out there in the tank for that storage. So, and those are what are dictated as how we have to have our storage as defined by the Virginia Department of Health.
Okay, thank you. And most of the capital costs, and I'll be interested in hearing this answer, but are not most of the capital costs being dispersed in your charge for tap fees with the payment by us as your customers for the water that you are purifying and for the sewage that you are cleaning up?
The capital costs are typically in the availability charge that new connections pay for connections to the system. We did not include the higher capital costs in that availability charge at this point. So that's kind of an unfunded amount right now.
You haven't, let me understand, you've assumed the $6.2 million. You haven't assumed the $18 million.
Correct.
How much of the district has been, at this point, built out? This water service area, excuse me. Are we at 20%, 50%, 75%?
Of the 600 zone, we're probably around 20 to 25% built out at this point.
Okay, so I guess, again, you might, depending upon the way the board goes, you just might have to recalculate your tap fees.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. You know, I appreciate the numbers, and, of course, Mr. Jennings had provided me numbers previously. The concern I have is that I have circulated that information to other water experts in other areas, and you know, I don't want to get into a debate with you right now. You folks own the information here. So I realize that says estimated, but the numbers that are there, you know, I would want an outside estimate just because, I mean, it's to your benefit, to be honest, to make the numbers look however you want in order to sell your case here for the elevated tanks. I understand that. One of the advantages of groundwater storage tanks is reduced construction costs from the information I have that depending on the size of the tank, construction costs 30 to 50% less than elevated storage. Now, that doesn't include the booster pump station or the standby backup power or the 10 to 30% less than elevated storage when a booster pump station or standby back power are included. You know, there's some cost efficiencies there. In addition, depending on the life cycle chosen, ground storage in conjunction with a booster pump station and standby backup power typically appears to be cheaper from if you look at it in a 20-year life cycle. So being that we haven't been in business in doing this, the groundwater storage tanks in Loudoun County, you know, I think it would be helpful to have, you know, outside estimates or quotes versus, like I said, I mean, it's to your benefit to make the numbers.
These estimates were actually developed by our engineer. I can provide the costs that were developed by our consulting engineer. They're not numbers that we've put together ourselves.
I have a technical legal question. Chairman York, I appreciate you bringing up changing tap fees, but the question becomes, pretend Supervisor Delgadio has bought a house in Willowsford and he paid whatever it is, 10 grand for a tap fee. And my house is under construction, but I'm not going to settlement until April. Do we run a problem if you have to go back and tell me that my tap fee is now $30,000 for my house?
If you've you've already paid for the tap fee, that is your fee. If you haven't paid for a tap fee and there's an increase in a tap fees, that's what you would be paying. The question for us is that what we want to set up? The point I was trying to make is that I just want folks to understand that because there may be an increase to cost, that cost may not be distributed to the whole customer service area.
That's why I was asking, I know, but that's why I asked my initial question in the first place, that without raising the tap fees, 18 minus 6, you know, where was this other $12 million going to come from?
Currently, we have one tap fee for all of our central system. We don't have separate tap fees for the 600 zone and separate tap fees for the 510 zone. So whatever new connections would occur, wherever they may be within our central service area, would incur that additional tap fee.
So you're saying if somebody lived in the 510 zone, kind of the Ashburn area, if for this you needed to raise the tap fee, going to my example, from $10,000 to $30,000, you're saying the poor slob who's buying a new house over in Ashburn would have to pay a $30,000 tap fee too?
Whatever that increase might be, yes.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, say that again.
We do not have a separate tap fee for different areas in our central service area. Everyone in our central service area pays the same tap fee. So if there is something that happens in the 600 zone that would cause an increase in the tap fee, everyone, wherever that new connection might be in our service area.
Okay, so that just lowers the increase per unit. Okay, thank you, because you're distributing over a much larger area.
Yes.
I was having problems pulling up the Fairfax County presentation, but one of the estimates that they gave for installing 11 new tanks at 8 new sites, 23 million gallons of new storage, 68 million gallons total storage was $31 million. $31 million. So we're talking $18 million. I mean, something just doesn't, it's just not right. Storage to provide 24 hours of operation, 22 new tanks, 19 new sites, 72 million gallons new storage, 117 million gallons total storage, 105 million, on and on. So that's why I bring it up. I'm not just throwing, you know, this at you. I did my research.
The only thing I can offer is that when you talk in the industry about tanks, and this has been my experience, you can say to somebody, what's it cost to build a tank? And people will say, oh, it's $1.50 a gallon or $2 a gallon or something like that. And you really don't have the context of the discussion. You talk to a tank manufacturer, he's just going to tell you the price to actually build the tank. He doesn't care about the cost for the foundation to develop the site, to put the pipes in or whatever. And so sometimes when costs get published on tanks, there's no context as to what you're actually discussing. So sometimes if you have a site that's fully developed and you're just adding a tank to it, the cost just to add that tank, you've already borne all those other sunk costs like developing the site, putting the piping in, maybe even having the foundation in place. So I'm just cautioning that when you look at reference numbers for costs for tanks, they can be all over the place, and you really need to understand what's being included in each of those costs.
Oh, I agree.
Okay. I know we asked lots of questions. I'm sorry. Do you have more of your presentation?
I think I had one more slide left, which really I think it was just a comparison again for us. We understand that the pumped ground storage has scores better on the visual impact, but really for us, the floating elevated storage, it costs less to build, it uses less energy, therefore has less environmental impact. Without the pump station, the operational maintenance costs are much lower, the reliability and so forth. It's just difficult for us to pose putting forward a solution that costs more money, that provides less reliability, and really only has that one advantage of the visual impact. I think that, and with that, Mark, I don't know if you had anything left for so many closing comments.
Yeah, just wanted to quickly close and talk real briefly, and we can get to any more questions around timing. When do we need this? We need it now. We've projected the time frame of when we would have these built, the first tank built. We've talked about the building out. There are connections being made in this pressure zone now. You're familiar, that Lena Run is going to be coming into our central system. That's an additional influx of houses. We've talked about the reliability, and for every day that we're not knowing what our path forward is and taking the next steps to go into design, permitting, and construction, that reliability is having a negative impact. So the time is now. We've been in this process for a couple of years now, really, and we're looking to move forward. What would we do if this isn't approved in terms of what the application asks for? Plan B, would we look at that alternative with the ground storage? We would have to take another look at that. Will we try to step back to screening and looking at other sites? As we showed, the options are limited, but that's what we would have to do. So with that, we're just open to any other questions.
Madam Chair. Just in terms of the site, and I appreciate the position you folks are. I just want you to know that, I do appreciate what you do in terms of providing water to the county and the challenges that you have. But one of the conditions for approval that the Planning Commission had for this application regarded access to the parcel and it not being off Red Hill Road, because we know how, I know Chairman's been over, I think Supervisor Volpe's been over there. I mean, it's just not feasible. So I appreciate the Planning Commission having done that. I have recent information as of yesterday that the property access to that parcel, the ingress egress that or right of way that you folks were trying to get, that contract fell through. That so therefore there is no access. You can't meet the conditions of the approval right now. They're nodding their heads, Madam Chair. So is there something you can say about that?
Yeah, we're aware of that, that the Willisford dropped that contract. It is back in the hands of the ownership of Mr. Rouse. I talked to his representatives 2 days ago because we were made aware of that. And just as we said previous to this, that we were comfortable with the mutual understanding that we could work something out with Willisford when they had the contract. We feel the same with Mr. Rouse. They affirmed that we worked out a contract. They're going to work something out. We began to talk about even looking at some language for the attorneys to start to look at. So at the end of the day, that's our risk, and we're comfortable with where we stand on that. So the condition is that we will not have construction access under Red Hill Road. We're comfortable with that.
Okay, so just, you know, and this would be something I think that needs to be followed up on. I just received this information late yesterday. It's my understanding that Mr. Rouse will not support anything that is of this height. He would support the on-grounding or the ground level tanks, or not, because of the issue with those water towers affecting that surrounding our area valuation.
Perhaps I can address it from a contractual standpoint. We do have an unconditioned contract with Mr. Rouse to acquire the property. It doesn't. It's not conditional on the height of the tank or the nature of it. So he certainly, if he expresses that viewpoint as a citizen and a property owner, it's certainly relevant, but it would not impair our ability to go forward with this acquisition and with this construction.
But you don't have a contract at this time.
We do have a contract for acquisition of the property for the tanks.
And no, I'm talking about for the access. This is entirely different. You may not be up to speed on that because your legal representation. This totally has to do with the driving physical access to the property, which is a different parcel of Rouse land than the parcel you're speaking of.
Understood. The as Mark indicated, he's had very recent conversations with the owner's representative indicating that they're willing to negotiate it. We always have the fallback position that if we can't come to a negotiated solution, that we could acquire that easement for the access by eminent domain and then obviously compensate the landowner for that.
For point of clarification, you have eminent domain powers as a public utility?
We have the same eminent domain powers as the county.
Okay. Thank you. Didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that either. That's I wonder. I guess Mr. Rouse doesn't know that either.
Mr. Chairman, you had a question. All right. Any additional questions?
Well, I have a number of questions here for Loudoun Water in terms of one of the things that you said, Mr. Peterson, is of course if we did not approve this special exception. Of course, you have the commission permit. You know that. You have that was approved, unfortunately, under extremely egregious conditions for the board and the community that came out and had to wait till almost midnight that night. It's just awful. But you have the commission permit. So if we do not support these elevated tanks as you have designed them, as you've proposed them, and we deny it, you're still able to come back and submit a different design, a different application for that parcel of land, unless you decide you want to move someplace else. So I just want to make sure we're all...
Yeah, we understand that. I think that, and as you mentioned, this application really is about the elevated. And it doesn't address, if we were to do ground storage, it changes how much traffic or, you know, those kinds of things. So it would be a new application. And why we continue to say we would have to really look at, is ground storage on this piece of property really the next best alternative? I think that's what we need to we would have to take a look at that.
I have a question with respect to the area, because the area that you drew also includes Hallen Burney Hanson Park, and that, and I know we went through all of this before, but if you were to approach this or reapproach this with a ground storage tank level approach, it would open up more possibilities for you, don't you think? In terms of parcels of land to consider?
If we were looking at ground storage?
Mm-hmm.
Probably, yeah.
All right, so...
Supervisor Clark, I think, Mrs. Pastor has a technical thing she needs to tell us.
Yes.
Yeah, the application before you, though, is, as Mr. Peterson indicated, the application is for this elevated tank. So
I clearly understand. That's what I thought. I was clear on that. That's what I was saying.
I'm just saying that to further discussion of where it could go, it's unlimited, and the impacts might be unlimited in terms of the, you know, if you go to a different site, there'll be a whole host of different locations.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman?
Because it was this where I had my question. If Supervisor Clark were to put a motion on the table, why wouldn't it be appropriate if she wanted to put a motion on for the ground level tanks, because the impact is less?
No, it's not. Not necessarily less.
Why?
Because we don't know what the technology would be, and it's not what it is not what we have evaluated. I mean, just as a sidebar, I don't necessarily agree that the visual impact would be less with a ground level storage tank.
Shorter, isn't it?
It's shorter, but it is at ground level and more visible to a person driving down a road. It's less impactful to the person maybe from the greenway looking at it, but in terms of the residences,
isn't it easier to screen a 40-foot tank versus a 180-some foot tower?
The base of what I'm talking about is that 40 feet of the spherical.
I understand that, Julie.
I don't think it would be less necessarily.
Well, and
pump stations.
Excuse me.
Things.
Getting to a technical thing. If you looking back at the little chart that they showed us, it isn't the exact same thing because you'd have to have the additional pump station facility located on the property as well. Okay.
I'm aware that I would need to deny this special exception or make a motion to deny this special exception, and then that would open it up for them to come back and propose a ground level or other location. So with that is what I would like to do. I move the Transportation Land Use Committee forward or to deny special exception 2013-0040 and SPMI 2013-0010, Loudoun Water 600 Zone, Red Hill Road Water Storage Tanks to November 5th, 2014, Board of Supervisors business meeting with a recommendation of denial. I meant to say forward special exception and SPMI
second.
With a recommendation of denial.
Okay, it's been moved and properly seconded to recommend to the full board denial. Discussion on the motion?
No, I have another motion consistent with what the chairman is saying after that.
Okay. I have a quick technical question. How many more water towers do you guys think you're going to need to build? You know what I'm saying? Are there 10 more of these that have to go in somewhere, you know, between the transition zone and the suburban policy area?
No, based on our current plan right now, maybe out around the years of 2030 or 2035, we've identified that we need some more storage in the northern part of our system. So somewhere up in the sort of the Route 7 area, northeastern area of our system is where we need storage. Just one more site is what we've identified.
Okay. So this isn't something where every 2 years we're going to have to worry about this. Okay. Thank you.
I do have one more question, if I may. Chairman provoked that thought, asking about why 2 1-million-gallon tanks. And you said that it could be 1 2-million-gallon tank. I thought I heard you say. Because we have that elsewhere, and the other jurisdictions, they'll build, you know, 2 million, 3 million, 5 million gallon tanks.
That's correct. But out in this area where the development is relatively low and there's not a lot of density, it may take a long time for us to gain the amount of development we would need to support that second 1 million gallons. So we would have to then really work from a water quality standpoint and operate the system much differently, and we would actually be putting an extra strain on ourselves to try to do that to make sure we are providing the right water quality to the customers. You'd have too much water sitting out in the tanks and not enough people using it. That's why we phase storage in. We build some, and then as the growth continues, we build the rest of it. So.
Okay. Are you aware of those tanks that are tank within the tank? So you basically can have two separate 1 million-gallon storage tanks in one storage container.
I mean, I've heard of something like that done, but it's not common.
You're talking like a double hole on a ship.
Correct, exactly, because they're using that as well in Fairfax County. So I just wanted to ask about that.
Seeing further discussion, all those in favor of the motion to recommend denial, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Those opposed, I will say aye. That motion will carry 3 in favor, with Supervisor Volpe voting no and Supervisor Higgins absent for the vote. Thank you, gentlemen.
I have a motion for staff. This is not for Loudoun Water. But I look forward to working with you folks moving forward, and we'll see where this goes. I move to direct county staff to work with Loudoun Water to determine pricing for ground tank options, sites in the 600 zone that can be considered based on the ground tanks, and to bring the information back to the board for presentation of options.
Second.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Either the motion needs to be revised, or I would just not do this until it gets to the full body. And if the denial then is confirmed by the full board, then that would be an appropriate motion to follow up.
Okay, well, I respect that, Mr. Chairman, so I will put that one aside.
Okay, your motion is withdrawn?
So I will withdraw, yes.
Okay, seconder agree?
Agree.
Okay.
Agree.
Thank you, gentlemen. We have one quick item. Mr. Quante has patiently waited for our quick update on the Zoning Ordinance Action Group. There's been, needless to say, lots of activity over the last few weeks. Good morning, Mr. Quante.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks.
It's almost afternoon.
That was an interesting discussion so to watch. We had a meeting, Julie and Scott and Charles and myself, with the ZOAG, and we came up with some new policies which we think will help us move things forward. And one of those policies was to be on the agenda each week for TLUC.
Each month.
Sorry. Yeah. But not necessarily have to take up your time, only if we have something to talk about. Actually, in this case, I think maybe you guys have something to tell us, because there were some changes on Wednesday.
That is correct. When the board was reviewing our strategic plan, you know, the nice big Excel spreadsheet that we have, a motion was made to change the order, you know, that the four kind of items that had been batched together kind of for, you know, phase three, the one that deals with mixed use business and the FAR averaging, that has been moved to the front of your list, and everything else then falls.
Okay, so rural was package one, so that'll be moved back.
That would be then package two, and then you'd have 3 and 4.
Okay, and where did home occupation and parking fall in there? They stay where they were?
Right, they stay in the order that they were in.
To clarify, and I think I did say this at the strategic plan session, is that we acknowledge that the ZOAG is working on all of these items.
Right.
It's just when they become amendments, or if they become actual amendments, that they would be taken up in this new order.
Right.
Okay, that's good, because we got actually different committees working on the different issues at the same time.
But we felt it was important for you to get that information, and I'm glad you came today so that you can talk to your subcommittee chairs and let them know, you know, for prioritization to help move things forward better.
All right, and thanks to the board for getting our two intent to amends finally adopted.
Yes.
So those will be moving forward, two recent ones.
Yeah, I'd like actually to publicly thank Charles Yud, because he did yeoman's work on the PDH telecom stuff, you know, at the last minute to, you know, correct a little difficulties we had with the draft. But yes, we're very excited about that. And, of course, I hope you will tell Mr. Pacioli that the intent to amend for the air conditioning units went off without a hitch. Everyone understands kind of some of these little technical glitches, and that some houses actually even have larger air conditioning units. I, of course, would like. Well, that was that. No, that was an oversight. That was a boo-boo. Okay.
And might be a little relief, but we don't have any new packages coming forward just yet.
Right. So. And I do want you to know that the board suspended the rules on Wednesday evening. So the new REDC representative, Mr. Hubbard, if I'm saying it correctly, is now a full-fledged member of ZOAC. Okay? Excellent. Thank you. All right. With that, we are adjourned. Everyone enjoy the weekend. It's supposed to be bright and sunny. Yes. Thank you.